Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with you every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and at your convenience on voiceofvashon.org. Today marks the third in a four-week series on Real Talk that explores the personal side of politics. That is, what today's politics mean to you. On this episode, we're exploring the potential impact of the November elections on climate change. I like to call it the climate crisis. To do that, I am most fortunate to have as my guest Kathleen Rogers, president of the Earth Day Network and leader of Earth Day 2020, a global effort to drive transformative change for people and planet. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be back.
It is good to have you back. I'd like to start by asking you to tell us about your upcoming October 24th event, the Climate Reality Project. What is that?
So there are three organizations that got together, the Hip Hop Caucus, which has been around for about 20 years, the Climate Reality Project, which is Al Gore's, Vice President Gore's organization that trains people around the world on climate change to make them both knowledgeable and to give them the advocacy skills in their communities, and Earth Day Network. So the three of us got together because we recognize that there is a ton of confusion out there on how to vote, when to vote, what the rules are, when you can mail, when you can't, when registration's over, what the impediments might be, and what do you do if something goes wrong. So we have brought together activists, celebrities, musicians, some great icons. I just heard someone from Star Trek Well Beyond, which will be fun. but it's a sort of, driving home the idea that it's really important. It's an imperative for everyone to vote this year. We all have, as we know, so much riding on it, particularly around environmental issues. But this is what we call a C3 event, a nonpartisan event, that will be focused on how and what you do to vote and why it's important. So it's fun to gather these people together. It's a ton of work, but we're hoping the product will be really good. And I think the big part of this for us is that we'll be conducting this two-hour special on October 24th, which is Vote Early Day. And it will have both at the beginning and end and pretty much all day long on Twitch, which honestly I'm not all that familiar with, but I'm really excited to be part of it. It's much, much bigger than YouTube. And we'll be on the homepage of Twitch for this, so we'll have tons of people coming on. It's a famous site for gamers, and we love having people that are not part of our community hearing our message. So I'm as excited about the fact that it's on Twitch as I am about everything else.
So I'm not familiar with Twitch either. How do we normal people participate? How can we get involved in and experience the Climate Reality Project on Twitch? How
so
do we get
to it? So if you go to the Twitch homepage, just type in twitch.com, from 1 to 3 on Saturday, that's East Coast time, you'll be able to find it. And you can also go through our website, earthday.org website, and it'll be on the homepage. You'll be able to log on from Facebook and Twitter and lots of other platforms. And anybody who needs information can mail info@earthday.org, and people will get back to you right away with the link.
Great. So that is the Climate Reality Project, which is just one of Earth Day 2020's projects. And you said it's going to talk about how important these elections are to us, particularly when it relates to the climate crisis. So let's get specific about that. What do you see the U.S. doing with the climate if Trump wins re-election? And then let's compare that to what you see if Biden wins the presidency.
Okay, well, that's a great question. As we all know, notwithstanding the crisis, the economic crisis that has driven down the economies of every country in the world, emissions are still growing. That much we know. And so while many of the signatories to the Paris Agreement are stepping up their commitments to reduce emissions, and the U.S. has always played a major role in catalyzing that good behavior. But we've also supported innovation, entrepreneurship, signaling to business that this is a way to solve this existential problem and to make money. But in the absence of our participation, we have seen the U.S. Play, even though they show up at some of these events, they really are no longer looked to as the leader. And so if he wins the second term, I see us, of course, not going back into the climate agreement. I see states and businesses going their own sort of ill-defined and less than perfect ways. But I think overall that undermines the ability of the U.S. to stay on top of climate and on top of the world's economic pile. So it's not just on top of the conversation, but it's also about making money. And except for oil and gas companies, I must say we do look like dunces. If Trump wins, I think it will also erode our ability to play a bigger role and in the business world as well. But just in sum, every company from banks to insurance companies to venture capital groups are already investing in green. And a signal from the president would change everything and make that investment a lot bigger. So I think we'll also end up propping up our multi-million dollar or billion dollar, excuse me, oil and gas subsidies. But where would the government be if we've chosen to prop up horse and buggy manufacturers at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution or old forms of heating or plowing fields or growing food? I'm sort of a student of the Industrial Revolution, and it's clear it was a real struggle, but some companies change, for example, from manufacturing buggies to manufacturing cars, but others kept doing what they were doing, so it turns out to be sort of Darwin at work. I can also talk about Biden.
Yes, please.
If you have time, and I think it's very different. Again, we have gone through 4 years of inaction, and our reputation for reliability is in the tank. We have to admit that to ourselves. And I travel globally, and there's just been such a shift. It used to be that people really wanted to meet me and talk about where the U.S. was going, but they don't anymore. And there are two areas of concern, the global one and then the U.S. problem. We can't just reclaim the international stage when we left it so abruptly and with so much contempt for everybody else who was trying. So it was a combination of leaving and then finding what they were doing to solve the climate crisis amusing. So while we'll have to establish ourselves and make commitments that we have both around emissions, but also on issues like climate, environmental literacy, and other areas of the Paris Agreement where we either need to step up on our goals or take some bold new action. And climate, environmental literacy, at least for Earth Day, is a major an important part of the Paris Agreement, and we're pushing that globally with or without the United States. Of course, in the U.S., and for those on the left, they are pushing very hard for broad climate change legislation, which addresses a huge number of issues that range from renewables to equity and inclusion and systemic issues. But there are those who want to bring along companies and state governments and unwinding the 4 years. So Biden has a lot of unwinding to do, for starters, and then we can look at restructuring our economy. So it is really important for us to recognize that we can't get everything done immediately because we do have to take care of the problems that we've faced. But I do think we also have to take care of the poor and the extraordinary division between the have and the have-nots. And as I always talk about, there are billionaires that strongly believe they're and have made plans for surviving on their own, but not for the rest of the people. So we do have to deal with the major issues that are sometimes looked at as tangential to climate change, but are really at the heart of it. And we have to address those in addition to emissions.
So it sounds to me like one of the things you're saying is that it is urgent that we solve the inequity problems, particularly in the U.S., but worldwide. Would you call that the most urgent climate crisis issue to address? Or if not that, what do you see as the most urgent climate crisis question?
Yeah, I think, renewables, carbon removal is a big, big issue. So even if we reach pre-1990 levels, we have to worry about the carbon that's in our system, and we have to remove it. That is a big, hot new issue, which includes using natural systems and tech. Even though it doesn't sound like climate change, it certainly is made of oil, and plastics is one that we really have to address for a whole bunch of issue, the reasons, not just the climate, but also that's where big oil company producers will start putting their money when they see their, you know, businesses decline over time as renewables and others replace oil and even natural gas. So they're building plastic factories everywhere. So we need to get rid of the oil.
Seriously? You're telling me that they're going to be making more plastics because though that theoretically,
even
with
US,
wow,
yeah, Africa, there are plastic factories popping up everywhere, making millions of straws and bags, just as some of our states get rid of them. So we have to deal with that issue. I don't think I'm alone in saying plastics is part of the climate crisis, but I'm certainly in the vanguard a little bit. Then there's also regenerative agriculture and saving our soils and finding a new way to grow food. For a lot of people, it's uncomfortable, but ending meat production and or reducing it has got to be part of the solution. And then, of course, reforestation. On the equity issue, it's one of those things I feel I'm so optimistic that I don't feel we can end poverty overnight. But I do think the equity issue and who gets to survive in a climate destroyed planet, on a climate destroyed planet. We have to address that because whether we like it or not, it's an issue that will face all of us through climate migration, which is already starting.
It is, and that brings to my mind the question of privatization of water accessibility, which I believe would dovetail with the idea of inequity. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, I'm certainly not a fan of, and I'm watching more and more projects in the Middle East, for example, because we have staff that are working on them, on these issues, watching countries get together and deprive other countries of their water. So that's sort of government. Certainly privatizing water would be the last thing on earth anybody should be a fan of, and dealing with who gets what. It's always been an issue in the United States and ever. We have very strange laws about who gets water where. It's true in the West particularly, and who can draw down what. It's a problem for California and other people. So drawing off water has always been an issue. But when you get to privatization, that's where I really stand up and start yelling.
Yeah, I would think so, especially if you're so involved with the notion of solving poverty. If you were addressing both American and global leaders, what would you tell them are the next steps humanity must take to have the greatest impact in mitigating the climate crisis?
So mitigation is a difficult word. I think because there's something that's, I mean, I know we have to do it, but it does feel like it's a little bit of a failure. And obviously, we need tech and other solutions for rising sea waters, and we have to restore the oceans and coral reefs and plastics and deal with climate migration, which are all mitigation avenues that we can take. But we also know that we can't really sandbag our way out of climate change. So we have to look at other ways of dealing with the climate crisis, including restoration, which for me, you've got climate mitigation, climate adaptation, and then you have restoration. And for Earth Day Network, for a lot of our partners, we're now looking at restoration as an equal opportunity for dealing with the climate crisis. And perhaps over the long term, if we get the tech right and can do the kind of analysis and restoration that we think can happen, that we can, mitigation will be less of a priority and restoration and will be what actually saves the day. And I feel the same way about adapting to climate change. It feels terribly defeatist. Not that we don't have to consider it, but both are relatively negative concepts.
Yeah.
But we do have to. We have to withdraw down the carbon and mitigate the damage. But I'm hoping we can also take a hard look at technologies to restore the planet.
To bring us back, yeah. Restoration to the planet, I think for some people, is kind of a new term. And to my mind, folded in with that is the notion of regenerative agriculture, carbon retention. Could you expand a bit more on the notion of restoration and how that might look?
Yeah, so there are many people around the world who have determined, back to the mitigation and adaptation conversation, that restoration is something that we've too long ignored. Now, this isn't to say that we're all going back to the Garden of Eden or anything quite close to that. On the other hand, there are a lot of amazing scientists and entrepreneurs and governments that have been working together for the last couple of years, and Earth Day included, that looked at a variety of technical solutions and what we call natural systems. So Tom Lovejoy, who's one of the fathers of so many things, a great scientist and well-known in biodiversity and other areas, is a one of the intellectual giants on restoration. And we've got, sort of received some great counseling about what it is we can do. Regenerative agriculture is certainly one, because the science is in, and there are two things. One is that a lot of scientists, ag scientists, these are not environmentalists necessarily, these are people who just deal with farming, are saying that we have upwards, but no more of, than 30 years to restore the integrity of our soils before we've depleted them to the point where we won't be able to grow anything. And that's a around-the-world statistic that I'm not particularly fond of hearing, because it's really scary.
Yeah, it is.
And so on the flip side of that is that soils and other fungi and all sorts of other things that are going on at sort of below the tree level or at the tree level, at the base of the tree level, including all of agriculture, but also forests, there are all these amazing processes that people are uncovering, both in terms of just general pure science, but also on the capacity of soil and other elements in the soil to help us regenerate the soil and also store carbon. And so a ton of research is going on and projects are going on looking at that. It's not that high tech. It's not like some of the other solutions, the sort of, believe it or not, I actually believe in this, which is like the sort of vacuum in the sky, getting the carbon out, whatever we can do. I've seen great, thoughtful scientists talking about the capacity of that to happen and to turn it into limestone or rocks or whatever they're talking about. But there are other things that will benefit humanity right away, which is restoring the soil that we all depend on around the world to grow our food. And when you get to that subject, you also have to talk about what we grow and what we eat. And
yes,
as painful as it is, we need to look at reducing to nothing our diet, and look at meat as the industry it is. It's bad for you. We know that. It's inhumane, and it's a major contributor towards the climate crisis. So if we can address both regenerative ag and plant-based foods and reducing or even eliminating meat, those things all work together incredibly well and can be a major component of the, efforts to solve the climate crisis. And in addition, protect the soil that we need for future generations so they can all eat. Which I'm actually increasingly worried about.
Yeah. And Alan Savory of the Savory Institute talks a lot about regenerative agriculture, using animals to restore the soil. And that would, I guess, require that either we just farm the animals or that somebody's going to eat them. And that kind of flies in the face of the notion that reducing our meat consumption is going to help regenerate the soil. And I realize there are many different ways to raise meat or to raise animals for meat. How do you see those two views dovetailing with one another in order to regenerate the soil?
Well, it's... it's difficult to imagine that anybody in this day and age would be a proponent of creating more opportunities for people to eat meat. because I don't care what country you're in, if you've been to the doctor or you read the newspapers, you know that eating meat, for the most part, I mean, people give you all sorts of levels, but they're kind of hedging their bets about whether or not we should eat meat for our health. So even putting aside the idea that we, you know, need meat or could stand to eat a little of it, the population of the world is growing and growing and growing. And every time we propose or promote meat eating in societies that either haven't done it or for all these new people that are born, it requires us to cut more forests and allow animals to roam the grazing areas. It's a major giant problem. So if the world population is going to increase by 1, 2, 3 billion over the next decades, then certainly it's not a smart idea to view animal production and you know, all of the ills associated with it as a way to deal with whether it's a health crisis or a climate crisis or a land use crisis or a biodiversity crisis, because they all fit together. You just can't clear any more land for animals. And so the other issues associated with, you know, shoving animals in small areas so that we can all eat more meat. It's super inhumane. And I challenge anybody who's been in the business or watches these videos to say that this is okay. And it's combinations of things, that climate and the humane treatment and the health and other things, I think are driving many, many people to say, okay, enough's enough. We've got to stop producing meat and animals and treating them the way we do. For something that's probably not all that good for us. And it's the same thing with processed foods. And we don't expect the world, none of us do, to change on any of these issues. And certainly the poor are the most impacted by this, especially in the United States, because they eat such cheap types of meat, and they eat processed foods, and because that's all they can afford. And I would like to see, as part of the climate crisis, really improving and supporting lower-income people to help them become healthy through their diets. And again, we all have done volunteer work. We've seen the kind of food that communities have been forced to eat because they live on food stamps and don't have the money to buy it. So part of my climate solution and the poverty issue that bothers most of us so much is around plant-based food and what we can do to improve the health and well-being of everybody in the world and not just the wealthy.
Well, and dealing with industrial farming and industrial meat production is going to be a huge political challenge.
Of course, it's a tough one.
Yeah. I would like to turn to plastic, because you mentioned that as the next great adventure for the petroleum industry. And I think about the gigantic island of plastic in the ocean. Do you know of any technology that is truly effective in, or could be truly effective in, beginning to dissolve that island of plastic?
Well, you know, at this point, plastic is ubiquitous. I've got it. I think many people have written this, that we all inhale, whatever combination it is, the equivalent of a plastic credit card every week, something like that. I can't remember what the stat is, but that's more or less. And if you looked at the skin, our skin or our organs, or if you went to the Arctic or Antarctic or any fish in the ocean and all of our meat and our soil and our clothes, it's all full of plastic, micrograms of plastic. So while the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is interesting, it's somewhere between California and Hawaii, and it's bigger than the state of Texas. The bigger issue for us, it'd be great to suck it up, and people are trying to do that. But the problem is there are multiple problems with plastic, one of which is it breaks down into teensy little pieces, and so it becomes impossible to suck up out of the ocean in any realistic way. And so getting rid of plastic and replacing it with something else entirely, not biodegradable plastic, nothing, but really challenging the world to solve this problem, which I know we could, is the only way out. We have to replace petroleum-based plastic with something else. Trust me, and I don't need to educate anybody on this issue. Plastic is very useful. It's useful in the medical profession. It's useful in so many ways, but it's unhealthy for all of us. And as I know Dennis Haynes and other people have written and talked about this a lot, that as plastics break down in the natural world, they mimic hormones like estrogen, and we've seen scientific studies. And I know that I've also seen studies of children that grow up around garbage dumps and unlined waste management facilities, that they're going through puberty early. Now, this is incredibly mm-hmm. disruptive, and I don't care if you're rich or you're poor. You don't want your children going through puberty at 7, 8, 9 years old. Whoa. And that's part of what we're seeing, the science on plastics. Nobody knows exactly, but it is a hazardous waste. And we, you know, drink out of straws and plastic cups, and our food comes in it. And all of that sheds into the product itself, whether it's our bottled water or our tap water. I don't care where you get it. I think 95% of our bottled water has a lot of plastic.
Oh, so of course, it's bottled
everywhere.
In plastic.
It's not just the ocean.
Yeah.
It's not just the ocean. It's everywhere. It's in our fish, our meat, our clothes, our hair. And so we have to deal with the problem, do more research on the medical issues associated of being around and absorbing and eating and digesting plastic and what happens when our animals do. But on the other flip side, getting rid of it because it breaks down into micro pieces. And by the way, when it does that, it absorbs heavy metals. It has this weird kind of magnet effect. So if you're a piece of plastic and you're floating through, as you break down, you're absorbing heavy metals that nobody wants a big concentration of. And so you're not just ingesting plastic, but also the heavy metals that the plastic absorbs and then is eaten by either land animals or fish. And so you're getting a cocktail of, again, not just petroleum products and all the other things that are in plastics because they have multiple chemicals in them,
mm-hmm.
but you're also ingesting heavy metals. And it depends on, again, the animal, the process, the place. But these are all things that are coming to light. And that and the going through puberty at a very young age is so incredibly unfair. And I know we can fix this problem.
Well, that's what, have 1 minute left, Kathleen Rogers. Kathleen Rogers, president of Earth Day Network and leader of Earth Day 2020. I want to close with hope. I know you carry all this information around with you every day. It's got to be a huge weight. What is it that gives you hope for the future? And can you tell me in 30 seconds?
Yeah, I think everybody in my business, and I'll bet you're the same way, we are born optimists. And so that optimism leads all of us and everybody, people in my community, the media, everybody, to keep on plugging away. And that's what we're going to do. And I think hope is all of our middle name because that's how human beings are. And I certainly have hope that over the next couple of years, we're going to help set the world on a pathway. But certainly optimism is the name of the game. And hope, to me, is less about control and more about being unsure. Optimism, on the other hand, drives everybody forward.
Kathleen Rogers, I can't thank you enough for joining us here on Real Talk. And I'm going to have you back. There's so much more to talk about. I hope you will return.
Anytime.
And Christiana Figueres coined the term stubborn optimism. Thank you for bringing us to that.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm, thank you. And remember, folks, November 3rd is Election Day. Vote, vote, vote. This has been Real Talk. Thanks for listening.